Welcome to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. I'm Sarah of the blog Sarah's Bookshelves. Each week, I'm talking with one bookish guest about two old books they love, two new books they love, one book they don't love, and one new release they're excited about. We're going to get real and sometimes a bit snarky about all things books. If you like the show, I'd really love your support. Spread the word to your reader friends, subscribe to the show, rate and review it wherever you listen to podcasts, or get bonus podcast episodes by supporting the podcast on Patreon. There's a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio to my Patreon page. Let's get rolling. Hey, everyone. Welcome to a full-length episode of Sarah's Bookshelves Live. I read a book recently that caused me to tear up at least 7 times in a single day, but you'll understand why when I tell you which book it is. It is The Only Plane in the Sky, An Oral History of 9/11 by Garrett Graff. And I'm sure you've heard me talk about it on social media. It's the first comprehensive oral history of 9/11, and it will absolutely knock your socks off. Given all that, I'm thrilled to have Garrett on the podcast with me today. He is a distinguished magazine journalist, best-selling historian, regular TV commentator who has spent more than 12 years covering politics, technology, and national security. He serves as the director of the Aspen Institute's Cybersecurity and Technology Program and is a contributor to Wired, Longreads, and CNN. He's written multiple books, including Raven Rock, a national bestseller about the government's Cold War doomsday plans. And y'all, this is a fraction of Garrett's bio. If you want to read more about everything he's done, you are welcome to check out his website, which has more detail about his background. Welcome, Garrett.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. Y'all, I want to let you know that today's episode is going to be a little bit different than normal. We are going to skip the rate it game at the end. That's usually a very lighthearted way to end the episode, but I feel like it's not quite fitting for what we're talking about today. And when I sat down to write questions for it, everything felt completely wrong. So we're just going to skip that section today. You've said that you wanted to capture how people experienced the day with your book, and more so than the facts of the day. And I think you did that beautifully. You really captured the humanity and the motion of it. And I personally felt like I was reliving the emotions I felt on the day of 9/11. So can you tell us, where were you on 9/11 and what were your personal feelings?
So I have a remarkably boring 9/11 story. I was in college. I was a junior in college and was having breakfast in the dining hall when a friend came by and told me about the first two crashes. And one of the things that I just really remember about that entire day, I mean, first, as quotidian as my experience was, I remember, you know, the details of it so vividly. You know, I could walk into that dining hall 18 years later and I could walk to the precise seat that I was sitting in when my friend came by. I also just remember the confusion of the whole day. I mean, the confusion of the idea that the towers could even collapse, the confusion of seeing a photo of Osama bin Laden on the television and wondering why everyone on TV seemed so sure that this person had attacked us, because I had never heard of him. I had never heard of Al-Qaeda. You know, these were sort of all new ideas and concepts to me that day. And that confusion, that sort of chaos of the day, was one of the things that I was really trying to capture with this book. As you were saying in your question, the challenge, I think, of 9/11 is, you know, this is the 18th anniversary this year. As this passes and we sort of see this event slip from memory into history, the story that we tell of 9/11 is a much neater and cleaner and simpler version of the history of 9/11 than the day that we actually lived. And that, you know, we talk about the attacks beginning at 8:46 that morning with the first crash into the North Tower and ending 102 minutes later with the collapse of the second tower at 10:29 that morning. But everyone in America that day, from school children to the president of the United States, you know, we didn't know when the attacks began. We didn't know when they ended. And we didn't know what came next.
I didn't realize how little, A, the people that were in the towers, B, even the president, how little everyone knew on that day. Us sitting at home watching TV knew the most, which was unbelievable to me.
Yes. And, you know, the President of the United States, as I sort of follow the title of the book, The Only Plane in the Sky, is a reference to Air Force One that day, which the president is raced aboard Air Force One. He's reading to school kids in Sarasota, Florida. The plane flies over the southern and southeastern United States for most of the morning, eventually landing in Louisiana and then flying up to Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska before it flies back to Washington late in the day after every other plane in the country has been grounded. And so during that final leg, effectively, Air Force One is the only plane left in the sky in the United States. But the President of the United States actually really didn't understand much of what was transpiring that day because there was so much confusion nationwide. And for as much as we think of 9/11 as part of our modern world, and I would make the argument that it is the beginning of our modern world, you know, it is sort of as clear a dividing line between the 20th century and the 21st century as we have. The technology available that day was the primitive Stone Age. And so the President of the United States that day had no email aboard Air Force One. There was no cable or satellite TV aboard Air Force One. So the president is relying on rabbit ears antennas to pick up local TV news coverage as he's flying around the country. And as you were saying, I mean, sort of you're left with this sort of stunning realization that actually the President of the United States for most of 9/11 actually knew less than the average American sitting at home watching CNN.
Which is unbelievable to me. And I think we make the mistake, or I know I do, of thinking, well, surely Air Force One has the best communications of anywhere. And how could this happen aboard Air Force One? It stunned me to realize that.
Yeah, and this, you know, that's sort of true over the course of the day, that actually the communication tools on 9/11 were just incredibly primitive. The White House sort of first finds out about the first crash that morning via a message on the two-way pagers that the White House was then using. People were really reliant at that point on BlackBerries as the cutting-edge technology on Capitol Hill. And the internet was still actually, you know, relatively primitive itself. I mean, in a way that would sort of baffle younger listeners, like the main national news source at that point was the homepage of Yahoo. And that was the way that a lot of people were sort of tracking this news as it unfolds over the course of the day. And it's just that was all part of the confusion and the fear of that day was how hard it was to actually track down information about what was transpiring.
Sure. So this book contains tons of little snippets of memories that are strung together in a way that tells an extremely compelling story. I loved how you were really able to juxtapose big players with regular people and large events like the towers actually falling with tiny small moments like what they were calling down the stairwell when a burn victim came down, which was move left, and that meant a burn victim was coming. How did you possibly do this? The amount of organization that this took just blows my mind.
So the book is a mix of original interviews and stories that I collected myself, and then original archived primary source oral histories that were done by a number of large institutions that went out and did 9/11 oral history projects after the attacks. Places like the 9/11 Museum in New York, the 9/11 Tribute Center, the Flight 93 National Memorial, the Pentagon historian, and the Capitol Hill historian. And I had a researcher who worked with me who had been a 9/11 oral historian. So she sort of understood a lot of this landscape. And we went out and collected about 2,000 of those primary source oral histories. And then we did them down over sort of months of drafting and editing and cutting to the final set in the book, which is about 480 voices coast to coast, morning to night, just that day of 9/11. And it's 9/11, you know, told only in the voices of the people who experienced it.
Right. And how did you make them feel like a smooth story arc?
I think the advantage of oral history for this particular story I had never had any interest in writing a narrative history of 9/11, because right. I think that that's actually a story that has been very well told. But the thing that has been left aside of that history is the human experience, the way that the day was actually lived. So trying to go back and capture people having the reactions that they were having in the moment, knowing only the information that they had at that moment. And it allows you, I think, to sort of have this different perspective of how 9/11 unfolds. And I'll use sort of two quotes as examples of that. One of the things that I think really comes through in this book is just how different America actually was on the morning of Tuesday, September the 11th, 2001. You know, we hear now and we sort of say flippantly and in passing, 9/11 changed everything. But we forget actually just how much 9/11 actually changed. And you see that in what to me is the most interesting moment of 9/11, which is the 17 minutes between the first crash and the second crash, where you see just how innocent America actually was that morning.
Right. Nobody thinks it's terrorism.
Nobody thinks it's terrorism. Everyone sees that first crash and like goes on about their day. And one of the quotes there that was just breathtaking to me when I came across it was Peter Johansson, who was one of the ferry captains of the New York Waterways commuter ferries that morning, talks about how he saw the first crash from New York Harbor as he was coming across the harbor. And they continue on into Lower Manhattan to Wall Street Terminal, sort of actually more or less at the base of the towers. And they dock, and every single person on the boat gets off and walks into Lower Manhattan, and that they're walking into work.
Yes.
As letters and papers are fluttering down from the impact zone in the North Tower around them. And they're like walking through this snow into New York City that day. There just wasn't a single person on the boat who like looked at it and was like,
maybe I shouldn't go.
Right. This just sort of seems like it's going to be a weird day. I'm going to go work from home.
Right.
And then you see that confusion and that innocence sort of unfold over the course of the rest of the morning, which I think is encapsulated again in, there's this quote from Denise Miller, who was one of the first police officers who arrived at the scene of the crash of United Flight 93 in Shanksville. And Denise Miller is showing up there, you know, it's still the morning of September 11th. And she really only knows four facts as she's arriving at the crash scene. You know, she knows two planes have hit the World Trade Center. She knows a plane has hit the Pentagon, and that this fourth plane has crashed in this field in her community. So she is standing there thinking that the terrorists were aiming for something in that field.
Oh, yes.
She thinks that something is buried under this field that's important that she doesn't know about, but the terrorists knew about. Because from her perspective, all she knows is they hit the Pentagon, they hit the Trade Center. There must be something important in this field. She also knows that there were two planes that targeted the World Trade Center. So she's standing there in that field scared because she's looking up into the sky thinking that there are more hijacked planes coming to hit that field, to blow up whatever the thing is that is buried under there.
Yeah.
And that to me is sort of one of those moments where we write that out of the history that we now tell of 9/11, because we now know why United Flight 93 ended up crashing there. And so we sort of skip over the confusion that unfurled through the whole community of Shanksville and across the entire country that morning, because we're all like, well, why did this plane hit there? What was going on there? And that it's those moments to me that really get at just how scary and confusing 9/11 was. Because again, you know, when we talk about 9/11, we just talk now about Shanksville and the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. And we forget how national the fear was. In Boston, they evacuated the Prudential Center. In Chicago, they evacuated evacuated the Sears Tower because they thought a hijacked airliner was headed towards the Sears Tower. In Florida, Disney closed, the only time it's ever closed because of a hostile action. In Toronto, they shut the subways down because they thought that the subways would be a likely spot to be attacked in Canada. And that we sort of forget about all of that level of fear that on 9/11, all of us thought that we were next.
Yes. And I remember I was living in Atlanta at the time. And once the second plane hit and it became clear what was going on, we all started thinking about, well, what's in Atlanta? The CDC is in Atlanta. And so we thought that was going to be hit. And going back to something you said earlier about the inflection point and how innocent we were versus how we respond to a potential threat now, I moved to New York on January 2nd, 2002. So a few months after 9/11. And I was there for the blackout. Do you remember when New York had a full city blackout in August?
Yeah. Yep.
The response to the blackout was quite different than everything that was included in your book about and how people responded to 9/11. I mean, we were out of our office buildings. Like, you wouldn't believe how quickly we got out of there. You know, we thought it was a terrorist attack.
Yes. That's the way that we react to everything now. I mean, you probably saw the video in August over the summer of the motorcycle backfiring in Times Square, and everyone ran for their lives.
Sure.
It's a different America now.
Yeah.
In a way that is actually really hard to go back and recapture just how different and innocent the country really was that morning when the attacks began.
Yeah. My husband still works in, we don't live in New York anymore, but he commutes every week up to New York and his office is in Times Square. And, you know, makes me a little nervous. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. All right. Switching gears a little bit. I know you did many personal interviews for this book. Was there a general demeanor that pervaded these personal interviews as these people reflected back, or was everyone kind of different? What was the sense or feeling you were getting from these conversations?
I would say a couple of different things stood out to me in the interviews. One was my general surprise that effectively every person I sought to interview was willing to be interviewed, which I was surprised by because, you know, for many of these people, you have this total stranger calling up and saying, hey, would you mind talking at length with me about the worst day of your life?
And you had some big names that you interviewed personally.
Yes. Although the big names, by and large, you know, the day was traumatic and terrible for them, but they were not necessarily people who lost coworkers or were personally injured themselves.
Right. Like a Katie Couric, for example.
Right. And so in some ways, the big names were among the easier of the interviews because they were more detached from the experience than, quote unquote, ordinary people who were actually caught up in the attacks. And then the other thing that sort of stood out to me among what I would sort of loosely term the ordinary people that I spoke to was how amazed they were that anyone would find their story interesting. And what I mean by that is Richard Eiken, who is one of the few people that you sort of follow through the whole day. And he's one of the only survivors from the 90th floor of the North Tower. And by only survivors, I mean, I think that there were like three or five of them. And he has this story, which I will sort of loosely summarize as he was on the 90th floor when the plane hit, is sort of caught in the explosion, makes his way all the way down out of the tower in time, bringing another woman with him the whole way so that she actually escapes and lives. And then he ends up in a hospital being treated for his injuries and gets scared of a follow-up attack and sort of breaks his way out of the hospital himself and flees across the Brooklyn Bridge with another woman from the hospital in their medical gowns with a Snapple as their only sustenance.
Right.
And it's like this sort of incredible story. And he read the book and he was like, you know, wow, I just couldn't believe that you found my story interesting.
And he was one of the ones you found from the oral histories, not a personal interview,
yes.
Right? Okay.
Yeah. And I was like, well, Richard, we went through 2,000 of these, and like yours is one of the like five most incredible stories that I came across. But to him, it's just his story. You know, it's just his day. And there's sort of another person who you sort of see that experience unfold, who gets home at the end of the day after surviving the attack and the collapse of the towers. And he's sort of surprised to discover that his Pop Warner Football League is canceled for that Tuesday night.
Uh-huh.
Because he hasn't yet thought of this as something that has happened to the country. He has just sort of been thinking of this all day as like he had a really bad day at work.
Right.
And he gets home and is like all set to go to football practice. And then they're like, no, dude, obviously football practice is canceled. Like the nation is at war. And he's like, oh, that's interesting. And it's just sort of those types of moments that you see these people just having their own personal experiences for the day.
Right. And not putting it in the broader perspective of what it means to the world.
Right.
So is there anybody that you desperately wanted to interview or find their thoughts in one of the oral histories and include in the book that you just were not able to get to for whatever reason?
So the one person who actually said no to an interview was President Bush.
I was going to ask about it. And it took me a while to figure it out because you're hearing from so many people very close to him and around him. I was like, oh my gosh, wait, we have not heard from him.
Yeah. And I originally was disappointed by that.
Uh-huh.
And am actually sort of quite happy with it as a storytelling bit now, that the only time you hear from President Bush in the book is in his own words, his contemporaneous remarks to the country as the disasters unfolded. And I actually think that that sort of works better from a storytelling perspective, because what you see, as you said, are sort of President Bush refracted through the people around him and sort of people reacting themselves to the way that he's reacting. Now that I'm on the other end of the project, I think actually having his voice in those scenes would have overpowered the views of the other people around him. And so I made the choice in the project to not go back and, you know, there were some people like the Speaker of the House or Vice President Cheney who have given interviews over the years about 9/11. And I used some of those interviews. And President Bush has spoken of what 9/11 was like. And I ended up deciding not to use other primary sources to fill in the president's words that day, but just leave him as someone who spoke only through his contemporaneous remarks that day.
That makes sense. And I never thought about it from a storytelling perspective. Now that you've explained it, that completely makes sense. Have the Bush twins ever spoken out about that day?
They have, not at the length or depth that would have been useful to me for this project. And you see a little bit of Laura Bush in it.
Yes, I noticed that.
But, you know, she is not someone that you actually follow through much of the day. She sort of pops up just a couple of times. And I sort of made the decision to not spend too much time on the Bush family, just for no other reason than the book was big and long anyway. And the first draft of it was twice as long as the finished version.
Oh, man, I'd love to read the first draft.
There's just so much that's interesting that day. I mean, I've been saying that, you know, I think that another journalist or writer, I'm sure, could sit down with the same pile of 2,000 oral histories that I used and write an entire other book that doesn't actually overlap with a single quotation that I used. There's so much drama that day.
Sure. So one of the other things I noticed, you were able to reveal a lot of information about the contingency plans and the bunkers and their locations. How was that possible?
So the funny thing there is, from an author's standpoint, this is a weird book that spun out of another book. So my last book, which you mentioned, Raven Rock, was all about the government's doomsday plans, which were sort of all designed during the Cold War. And so they've sort of become public in the years since the end of the Cold War,
right,
which used to be big secrets then. And ironically, the only time that most of those plans were ever used was on 9/11. So when I was writing that last book, I became very interested in President Bush's day, because part of the policy challenge of 9/11 is that we tried all of these emergency doomsday plans that day, and literally none of them worked. Nothing worked in the way that they were intended.
Right. Different kind of threat they were built for.
Exactly. Well, and it also turns out that part of the fundamental challenge in doomsday planning is you're asking people to sort of choose between their official capacities and their humanity.
Right.
You know,
right.
Do I evacuate to a bunker or do I stay with my family? If I'm the president, do I get to my desk at the White House to reassure the country, or do I hide aboard an airplane out of touch but safe?
Which is a huge theme in your book.
Exactly. During that last book, I became very interested in President Bush's day. And so that led me, in 2016, I wrote the article that sort of launched this book that was the same title, Only Plane in the Sky, that was just the President's Day aboard Air Force One. And then the reaction to that piece actually is what led me to then turn that into this book, which is the full story of 9/11. So this was a weird path to this project, just because it was something that I kept getting more and more interested in.
Right.
This is the fourth book I've written on national security issues. And for all of the previous ones, 9/11 is this major hinge. It is this sort of moment where the country is tested. And I wrote a book on the FBI and counterterrorism, wrote this book on the doomsday plans, and wrote a book on cybersecurity. And that for each of those stories, 9/11 is the moment when everything changed. And in some ways, everything that I write about in my normal life as a journalist, whether it's the FBI or DHS or the border or counterterrorism or the rise of the surveillance state, these are all basically creations of 9/11.
Absolutely. So I want to end our discussion portion with one last thing that jumped out at a friend of mine when he read your book. He was on the 64th floor of the South Tower on 9/11. He worked for Morgan Stanley. So he read your book and he said one of the things that really jumped out to him was the guilt that people that either went into work late that morning and missed everything. I remember the executive chef of Windows on the World ends up getting his glasses fixed and misses the entire thing. And basically his entire staff is more or less wiped out. Or somebody who was there but escaped unharmed, which is the case of my friend. Or somebody who didn't notice something, like the case of the ticket agent who checked in the terrorist for one of the flights. And he feels that guilt incredibly. He's like, I lost my cell phone, my wallet, and my jacket, and I slept in my own bed that night. And that's it. So he said he'd always wondered how the officials and the administration from the Clinton years, do they feel any sense of guilt, and have any of them really gone on the record with the USS Cole happened during that period? Bin Laden was on John O'Neill's radar, but nobody was quite understanding the level of the threat. And then as they're sitting back watching 9/11 happen, what's going through their minds?
Yeah, it's a great question. And on the sort of luck or fate question that your friend touched on, I mean, that to me really was one of the most poignant themes of the book, is the way that these incredibly small decisions that people have that day, you know, when to run an errand, when to get a cup of coffee, what plane to catch, what train to catch, the types of decisions that we make 1,000 times a day without any thought for what alternate futures or universes they might unlock, that really is a major theme of life and death that day, of, you know, the people who turned left coming out of a room rather than the people who turned right.
The sheer number of people that talked about decisions like that was astounding, and how that really just hit them in the gut, realizing the impact of such a small thing.
And I think that sort of survivor's guilt is a very real and important object. And one of the things that you sort of touch on in your question is, you know, how did Clinton people react? The most visible reaction, the one that has sort of stood out in history, is Richard Clark, who was the counterterrorism coordinator at the White House during 2001 and during the Clinton years. When he came to testify before the 9/11 Commission, he literally apologized to the families and the victims and said, "Your government failed you." And one of the things that is just very clear, and it doesn't come through in this book because that's not the point of this book, is the extent to which this was a situation where there were opportunities to interdict or disrupt this plot that the U.S. government missed. The clearest example of that being the CIA actually knew in the summer of 2001 that two of the hijackers, Nawaf al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Mihdhar, were actually inside the United States, and they never told the FBI. And it is hard now to sort of look back at all of those and realize, you know, frankly, sort of how close we could have come to disrupting this plot and that we didn't. But there were reasons why information didn't get shared. There were bureaucratic reasons. There were prioritization within agencies in terms of resources that mattered in this story. And it is just really hard to look back and realize how we could have handled this differently and actually ended up with a very different outcome.
Absolutely. All right. Should we talk about your book recommendations? I feel like that's a hard transition to make. In honor of the fact that you have so beautifully documented history, and also that Nonfiction November is going on right now, most of Garrett's book recommendations are going to be nonfiction. Not all, but most. And instead of talking about a book he doesn't like, he's going to share three new books that he loves instead of two. All right. As always, Garrett's going to share two old books he loves, three new books he loves, and one new release that he's excited about. Can you tell me about the first old book you love? Or books, I should say, plural.
Yeah, I have sort of two categories of old books that I love. The first, on the nonfiction side, Robert Caro's Biographies of Lyndon Johnson, which is, you can either sort of count as one enormous book, or I think it's four enormous books on their own right now. I think it is just an incredible story of American politics and also an incredible story of power and how political power is used and accumulated. And it's, to me, just probably the best nonfiction that has been published in the last half century.
And I read somewhere that he's working on a fifth and final LBJ biography.
Yes, he is working on the fifth, which is actually the one that deals with all of Johnson's presidency. So we'll sort of see how that goes.
Okay. That's amazing that there are four books about Johnson and you haven't even gotten to the presidency yet.
Yeah. And all of us who are Robert Caro fans are eager for him to get out there and finish it. And he wrote another actually great book this year about writing and researching and reporting. And as good as that was, I think all of the fans of his biography were like, man, what are you doing wasting time on another book? Like, finish the LBJ ones.
I can see how that would go down with the rabid fans for sure. And for the listeners, the first book in the series is called The Path to Power, and that was published back in 1982. So that was Robert Caro on LBJ. And the first book in the series is The Path to Power. So tell me about the second old book you love. And again, this is an author, not a one book.
Yeah. So my favorite fiction writer is Graham Greene. And I have been sort of fans of his books since I started reading him, you know, probably 15 years ago. And sort of his three classics, of course, are The Quiet American, The End of the Affair, and The Power and the Glory. And was a British writer and incredible human and, you know, amazing life of his own. But his books have just sort of always been among my favorite fiction.
So he writes sort of Catholic novels and also thrillers. Do you have a preference between his two very different types of books?
The Catholic novels, actually, to me, and I am not Catholic and not religious, but they are actually, to me, the most incredible of them. The Power and the Glory being the most famous, about a whiskey priest, as Graham Greene calls him. And it is an incredible portrait of a obviously fictional human, but Catholicism is a really major theme of a lot of Graham Greene's writings.
Sure. And is that your favorite one as well, or just the best known?
That is probably my overall personal favorite of his books. End of the Affair and Quiet American are sort of the other two that are right up there.
Right. I feel like those were the two that I had heard of prior, The End of the Affair and The Quiet American. All right. So that's Graham Greene as the author. So tell me about the first new book you love.
As someone who mostly reads nonfiction, which is both what I write and then what my work requires me to read, I think that this is sort of one of the most amazing years that we have had in narrative nonfiction in quite some time. And there's just been like a pile of incredibly good books this year that, again, as someone who writes nonfiction, have been very humbling to see these incredible projects come out by other writers. And there are three that really stand out to me from this year. And the first of them is Adam Higginbotham's Midnight in Chernobyl, which is about the Chernobyl incident. And it's technically unrelated to the, was it HBO or Showtime series about Chernobyl this year, but it's a great companion to that series if you are so inclined, or if you thought the show was too terrible to watch on TV and just wanted to read the history. The history is incredible. And part of what stood out to me, again, as someone who writes these types of books, is Adam is able to make that world of the Soviet Union in the early 1980s come alive at a level of detail that I was just in awe of him trying to. I couldn't even figure out how you could reverse engineer some of the sentences that he was writing in order to have done the research to be able to say the things that he's saying. And it was just so impressive, particularly given that he's doing it about a country that speaks a language and source documents that are in a language other than the one that he's actually writing in.
And I'm sure it's not that easy to access a lot of that stuff. I mean, I imagine they're still pretty secretive about it.
Yes.
When I was looking up this book before we recorded today, I did find somewhere that said it kind of reads like a sci-fi thriller, which I think for my listeners is always important. They like nonfiction that reads like fiction. And I also didn't realize, I think the book goes into this, that all the political implications of Chernobyl and how it really contributed to the USSR kind of losing the Cold War, I had no idea. And I always just knew it was an explosion, but I never knew the background about it. All right, tell us about the second new book.
So the second one that I would sort of single out from this year is Casey Sepp's Furious Hours, which is about Harper Lee, the author of To Kill a Mockingbird, and a murder case that she became very interested in and sort of tried to write about and never actually did. It's just a beautifully written book. Again, as a writer, I was insanely jealous of Casey's way with words and her writing style, because there are, you know, on any given page of this book, sentences more colorful and perfect than anything that I will ever write as a writer.
And I did hear it was going to be her version of In Cold Blood that just never happened.
Exactly right. Part of the history of it that I might have known at some point but had forgotten was that she was actually quite involved in Truman Capote's world and the writing of In Cold Blood, and that this murder trial that never happened was sort of her, in some ways, professional jealousy at his success with In Cold Blood.
Right. And she helped him do a lot of the research for it, I believe.
Yes.
I wrote my junior year high school term paper on In Cold Blood, which is kind of crazy and sort of an out there choice, I think, at that time. But I loved that book.
I think that's probably about the last time I read In Cold Blood, too. So that's why I was like, I might have known this at some point and have forgotten it, because it's been probably 20 years since I read In Cold Blood.
And I love true crime. And In Cold Blood was sort of my gateway to realizing that I loved true crime. All right. So that was Furious Hours by Casey Sepp. And that's been around on Instagram a lot for the listeners. I'm sure y'all have seen posts about this book. All right. Tell us about the last new book you love. Not the last, the third.
The third.
Yes.
So this is another narrative nonfiction murder mystery type book. Say Nothing by Patrick Radden Keefe, which is a true story of murder and memory in Northern Ireland. And it is similar to the way that Midnight in Chernobyl is the story of the Chernobyl accident set against the backdrop of all of the rot that is at the core of the Soviet Union in 1980. This is the story of a murder amid the troubles in Northern Ireland that is effectively a history of the IRA and, you know, what unfolded in Northern Ireland and the cost to the families and the communities there that were affected by it. It's a tremendous book. It was just long listed actually this fall for the National Book Award for nonfiction, and I just couldn't recommend it enough.
Did it make the finals? Have they announced those for nonfiction yet? I know they have for fiction.
I do not believe that they have announced the finals yet.
Okay. I like it when nonfiction authors take sort of a broad event and use a very small personal story to tell the story, if I'm saying that correctly.
Yep.
Like takes the murder of Jean McConville and then uses it to tell the story of the IRA conflicts in general. So I like that personal hook, if you will.
And some of what I, to me, again, this was an area that I just didn't know that much about, was realizing just how incredibly terrible the troubles really were at a level that I had never dealt with and interacted with that era of history before.
Right. And I knew nothing about it. All right. So that was Say Nothing by Patrick Radin Keefe, and that came out in February. Tell us about the new release that you are excited about, but you're more than excited about it. It's already out, y'all. So it just came out.
Yes. As I said to Sarah when we were talking before, I'm counting this as a new release because it is the book that I have been most looking forward to this fall. And it's by an author named Paul Hendrickson, who is, again, a great creative nonfiction writer, former Washington Post writer, and it's his new biography of Frank Lloyd Wright, Plagued by Fire, The Dreams and Furies of Frank Lloyd Wright. And Paul is just this, again, incredibly talented writer. His last book was Hemingway's Boat, which was a biography of Ernest Hemingway sort of told through the window of Ernest Hemingway's boat, Pilar, and sort of his relationship with the ocean and with fishing. And Paul writes a book every 5 or 6 years, and they are just incredible events and such meaty, and the equivalent of like a really meaty meal and a fine aged wine.
And Frank Lloyd Wright is a character.
Yes.
I mean, he is a good topic. And I'll say this because my listeners, many of them have probably read this book, but have you ever heard of the book called Loving Frank?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's historical fiction, and it's based on his affair with his client, Mama Cheney. He just seems like this fascinating, kind of terrible in some ways, but very intriguing character that might be very interesting to read nonfiction about, and a good pairing with the book Loving Frank, if you kind of like to pair a fiction and a nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
So that was Plagued by Fire by Paul Hendrickson, and that was out October 1st. And y'all, if you are looking for, this is a huge generalization I'm about to make right now, but looking for like dad books for Christmas, I think a lot of the books we talked about today that Garrett shared would make excellent dad picks for holiday gifts. I know that's coming around. All right, Garrett, thank you so much for being here. I so enjoyed talking to you and appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule. I know you've got a lot going on to share with us all the background behind The Only Plane in the Sky.
Well, thanks. It's been fun to have the chance to sort of talk about it at a more book level than a thematic level.
Yes, yes. That's what we try to do here. So before you go, can you tell everybody where they can find you online?
I'm at GarrettGraff.com or VermontGMG on Twitter.
Great. And y'all, we are doing a US-only giveaway of The Only Plane in the Sky, and that's courtesy of Avid Reader Press. To enter, if you could tag two friends on my Instagram post for this podcast episode, and make sure you're also following Sarah's Bookshelves, and I will be drawing the winner of the giveaway at the end of this week. So I will let you know who wins on my Instagram stories. Also, the second Superlatives episode for Sarah's Bookshelf Live patrons will be airing at the end of the month, and it will include Garrett's picks for categories like Best 9/11 Book, other than his own, and the toughest interview he did for this book. If you'd like to get this bonus episode and a new Superlatives episode every month, you can support the show for $5 a month on Patreon. And now is a good time to sign up because there will be some fun year-end bonus episodes coming. Next week, we will be having a mini episode. Talk to you next week. Thanks so much for listening to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. You can find show notes with all the books mentioned in the episode, purchase links, and linked timestamps at www.sarahsbookshelves.com/podcast. And that's Sarah with an H. I'd love to hear your comments, feedback, and suggestions. You can find me online on my blog, sarahsbookshelves.com, on Twitter at Sarah's Shelves, on Instagram at Sarah's Bookshelves, and via email at sarahsbookshelves@gmail.com. And if you'd like to get exclusive bonus episodes of the podcast, you can support us on Patreon at www.patreon.com/sarahsbookshelves. And there's a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio to my Patreon page. Thanks for listening.